across the galaxy. This is where conspiracy on the wild side meets the perspective of a lifetime. This is the Free Zone with your host, Freeman.
All right. Well, I guess the hardest part for me is limiting the concepts that we're going to talk about today.
I hope you got a watch.
Yeah, I do. I'll keep us on target, and about 45 minutes in, I'll start to lead us towards our final thoughts, and because we're doing an hour, right?
That's right, yeah.
Okay. So, I thought I would, I don't know if you got a chance to look at that picture, although I'm not even going to bring it up, but I thought I'd share with you that I've been to a number of these places and actually performed the first ever all-night ritual with the Mayans at the Pyramids of Tikal.
Oh, good for you.
And that was quite amazing. And when I was listening to one of your shows, it made me think of when I went down to see the tomb of Pakal. It was Monday, and I have learned in all of my travels, do not go to the museum on Monday. They are all closed.
Yeah, found a nice closed sign, did you?
Oh, my Lord. I walked, you know, 2-3 miles downstairs. I mean, the stairs just don't end, right? It's like 2-3 miles of stairs. I'm not kidding. And I had my camera out, and there were Mexican guards there with Uzis trying to tell me I couldn't film, but I don't speak Spanish. So I was just like, no habla español, and just kept going on, like hoping they weren't going to shoot me in the back. Actually, I had to face a shotgun to go up to the pyramids. So at Palenque, I was at, you know, Pakal. And with Uzis, but at the Tikal, I was facing shotguns, and they weren't going to let us go in and do this all-night ritual. And it had already been okayed and agreed by the government and all this, and all the Mayans were Masons. And it was such a strange, surreal thing to see them in their ritual garb suddenly all pull out their cell phones and start calling their government connections to make sure that it could happen. But that didn't stop a guy from sticking a shotgun in my face. Why me?
Just want international currency. It's called a $20 note.
Yeah. I mean, it was. I don't know why me. There was a whole group of us walking in, but I guess I looked the easiest to target.
Usually, I find that. I mean, I just came back from there and did the same thing. We're at Pakal's tomb, which is extraordinary. I mean, it's funny because so many ancient alien people and that. Ilk, they seem to think of this guy as sitting inside a space capsule looking up at some strange instruments, looking at the stars, and it's nothing to do with that at all. I mean, if you understand the symbolism, it's he actually describes the path of the initiate. He was one of the last people in Central America to actually typify that. You just have to understand the imagery that this man has become the center of the three worlds. He's just escaped from the underworld. He's learned the mystery of life and the mystery secrets. He's about to go to the other world, and he basically is the tree of life. He is the trunk that supports all three levels. And it's so beautifully carved. I mean, it's the classic depiction of the path of the initiate, the sort of the resurrection ritual, if you like. And I'm just kind of have a little laugh whenever people say, oh, he's inside a space capsule. Of course he's not.
Yeah, I mean, it does look like it. You can't deny that, but...
Oh, at first sight, yeah. But well, you have to basically look at the symbology of the area and then go, oh, okay, I get it. Right. And you see the hat, the mouth of the monster, the Witz monster, they call it, which is the a kind of a metaphor for the fact that when you go into so many of these pyramids, they're not burial places. They weren't burial places to begin with. You have to be dismembered in this lifetime in order to access the other world while you're alive. And that's the whole point of initiation. The idea is that you have to remove as much as your flesh or your physical baggage from your body as much as possible in order to have this deeply shamanic experience of traveling to the other world, staying there for a few days and then coming back. And that's what the monster really is. I mean, it's very much like the Egyptians with the story of Osiris. I mean, has anybody ever questioned the fact that it took 72 conspirators to kill and chop up Osiris's body? it sounds like a little bit too many people required to cut up a body. And of course, the whole thing is metaphoric. It's symbolic. You have to basically dismember yourself, deflesh yourself in order to leave the body and then go traveling in the other world and return. But until you know that, it does look like a spaceman inside a capsule.
Right. Yeah, and we're quite the opposite today. Now we're piling it on as heavy as we can and not finding any peace in our God self.
It's all there. You know? We just forget about it.
Right, right. Well, I thought since we only have an hour's of time, we might go a few places that I haven't heard you go, so I don't know whether we want to go this direction or not. But I was going to open with the idea of Nicholas Roerich in the Master Building. Are you into that?
Not so much, no.
Okay. Then we could... yeah, you'll have to look into Nicholas Roerich for sure.
I'll make a note of it.
Because he's the guy who put the pyramid on the dollar bill, so I thought that would be a good way to start a conspiracy show.
Oh.
But there's all kinds of places. I thought we'd look at some of the magicians, like Apollonius. Are you into Manly P. Hall?
I've got a lot of his books, actually.
Yeah, I assume that.
In fact, I was just up the... I live up the road from where they... They used to have a really good publishing company, and I used to go there on weekends and just look at these books behind glass, you know, the days when I couldn't afford that stuff.
Right.
I found an original five-color gravure version of Secret Teachings of All Ages, and I just used to just lick the glass, hoping to get on the other side and touch it.
Yes.
It's amazing.
I did finally get my silver copy with the gold, with the color plates, and it's, yeah, definitely a treasure of mine.
Oh, I'll have to I'll have to arm wrestle you for that one.
Yeah, yeah, you will. That with my Schwaller Delubrates, I'll battle to the end. It took me forever to get the Temple of Man. I mean, that was like,
yeah. Not only was it written in Alsatian French, which is difficult enough to begin with, then it had to be translated through German into English. Written in the Victorian era, which means they have commas everywhere.
Right.
So you have to read it slowly as if you are a Victorian, not in our age. You have to read it much, much slower. I know people who've taken a week just to read one page, but rewarding nevertheless.
Right. Yeah, I honestly, yeah, that's about it. You know, you pull it open, you're like, okay, I've gotten this far. But it did, I was at architectural school at Kansas University. It was where I was introduced to that whole theory, and I'm pretty sure my professor was a Mason, and he sparked my interest in all of this. I mean, of course, you know, on a greater level, I should say. All right, well, we've got all kinds of places to go, and
let's go there.
All kinds of things to talk about, so this will be great fun. I'm really looking forward to it. Shall we begin?
Yeah, I thought we already had.
I know. I have been recording, and maybe we'll just let this air and say, all right, let's start the show.
Absolutely.
I don't mind that.
I like that.
So, folks, let's start the show. Welcome to the Free Zone. It is so wonderful to have you here, and we are going to have an exciting talk today because we are looking at divine resurrection and the living resurrection experience. Now, are we living in interdimensional mansions? We're going to get into this and the architectural connection with our consciousness with Freddie Silva. And he is a best-selling author of numerous books, Chartres Cathedral, Secrets in the Fields, The First Templar Nation, The Divine Blueprint, and most recently, The Lost Art of Resurrection. And we're going to get deep into our consciousness studies as we have been. And let's get into this cosmic dance as we explore the connections between our 3D reality, the creation of archetype temples, and our consciousness. So it's so great to have you here, Freddie Silva. And I should mention that your website is I should mention that Freddie Silva's website is invisibletemple.com, and you want to get over there and check this stuff out. So I'm hoping today, Freddie, that we're going to leave our audience inspired to go seek this knowledge and look into some of the crazy characters that have come throughout time that seem to be miraculous, and then learn our ways as we go along to understand how we can return to our miraculous nature through this living art of resurrection.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. So let's begin with the man who could not die, Enoch, in the Enochian stories, and the tale of Enoch as he traverses the different mansions within God's house. How did this story get told? When you read the story of Enoch, I mean, it describes him leaving the planet, and it's amazing in its tales, and I think it'd be a good way to lead into this topic.
Oh, absolutely. It is fascinating. In fact, I was just reading another account by another researcher that describes Enoch's sort of journey to the stars, and it's almost like he's on. It's a two-level book, like most ancient books. There's a first perceived level, which is a sort of a portrayal of an actual story, maybe, and then there's another hidden book in there, in the tradition of the mystery secrets, and that's the one that kind of excites me, because when I start reading between the lines of his journey, it's almost as if he's actually describing the initiate's journey from this lifetime. He's left the body, but he's still alive in his physical life. He's just having this shamanic journey, and then he sort of wanders the other world. He connects with stars, he connects with different levels of reality. He's privy to specialized information, as all the initiates are, and then he returns and goes about his merry way in his daily life and applies all of this. On one level, that would seem to me that one of the earliest descriptions of the path of an initiate, but at the same level, there's also the true aspect of it and how old the story is. And I was I can't quite place right now the source of this information. It'll come to me eventually. This happens when you've gone past 50 years of age. Parts of your brain don't quite work the same way as they used to. But I was very interested to see that there's some research done that the story may be as old as about 8,000 BC, certainly far older than it's given credit for in the Bible. And he actually gets apparently taken on a journey by some beings who are humanoid, but they're very different to us. They're much taller. They certainly possess complete understanding of the stars and even the roundness of the earth, which technically no one was supposed to have back then. And he basically gets taken to the Nordic lands, because if you actually start reading the story carefully and seeing the depictions of the positions of the stars, he actually gives away the latitude where he was taken to, which is actually northern Scotland, which seems like a 1,000 miles away from the Middle East where the story begins. But it's interesting in that the way he describes the sun and the position of the sun relative to the sky and the horizon seems to define the fact that he was being shown a part of the earth which is very, very northern in latitude. And I think at this one point in the story, he even describes the Aurora Borealis, which you do not see in the Middle East ever. And he is told about the matter of the heavens, how the earth goes through certain cycles of destruction and upheaval and then rebuild itself. And he was told to basically design this big earth clock made out of very large stones. And he essentially is privy to the building of some of the sacred sites and the big stone circles up in the Scottish Islands. And it's interesting that today we have, through the wonderful act of global warming, wonderful storms up in the northern British Isles that are beginning to erode the Scottish islands, and new wonders are coming to the fore. And some of these on Orkney have revealed that, yes, around that time, there appears to have been a group of people who seem to have come all the way from the Middle East, all the way up through the Black Sea, all the way through Norway, and they eventually ended up building these stone circles on the Scottish islands, and they seem to go to around that era between 6 and 8,000 BC. So this is what I like about these stories, the fact that they're on one level they give you a certain truth that actually occurred, and written in such a way that it makes it so incredible that you remember it. That's the wonderful thing about a great tale. Important things are written in such a way, such an extraordinary color, that you can actually remember these from generation to generation. But also when reading between the lines, you've got a completely different story. So it's two for one.
Right. Have you ever seen Smallville?
The film?
Yeah, the TV show.
No, you know, I don't actually have television, oddly enough.
I understand that.
I worked in it for 15 years. I thought, I can't take any more of this.
Very understandable. Well, you know, we were talking about mythology and these stories sticking with us and how it carries this knowledge. And I recently sat through 10 seasons of Smallville. Yeah, I do that. But I do it for, you know, study. I do it for understanding because I'll tell you, in Smallville, they equate Clark Kent to Jesus so many times. And he even, almost every character goes through a death and resurrection. But in Clark Kent's case, he actually dies in a crucified position and then is resurrected. And they tell him that he is the light, the savior of the world. And they,
now that you've said that, I'm gonna have to get that out of the library.
You gotta check it out. I mean, you gotta make it through all 10 seasons to get the full epic tale.
Yeah.
But they even equate Clark Kent and Superman, resurrection and all, to Osiris. And Osiris is a character. They bring in Isis. And they end up having to battle Osiris, who seems to be a Lord of the underworld in this tale.
Yeah, I mean, if you, you have to understand the history of implementing this information, which back in the Middle Ages, if we were having this discussion back then, right now there'd be a bang on your door and there'd be people dressed in large robes coming out to burn you alive. I think we learned that lesson quite well. And the only way to keep this information going, all of these mystery secrets going, is to keep finding new methods of incorporating him into popular culture to avoid, you know, charges of heresy and all kinds of other nefarious things which will get you killed. And, you know, people like Walt Disney and to some degree, and I think to even a bigger degree, George Lucas, whether he was aware of it or not, they incorporate all of this information into seemingly popular things like Star Wars. I mean, the Star Wars, everybody talks about Luke Skywalker and Han Solo, but really the star of the show is Anakin Skywalker, who begins with the light, he's tempted by the dark side, and then he redeems himself at the end. Again, it's a path of Osiris. He gets chopped up into a million pieces, goes to the dark side, comes back a much better man, and he realizes, that's the big picture. So it's. I totally agree with you. There are many formats in which people who understand these things, they read this stuff either through books or they join Scottish Rite Freemasonry. And then in order to get the information out in a certain way that tempts people to inquire further, because it does require a certain amount of your time to understand these things properly, they encode the information into popular themes like a cartoon. I think Duckman, has a lot of stuff in there that I still haven't quite figured out yet. And I think The Simpsons sometimes incorporates things on the sly. And this is how they do it to you. They get your attention, you become curious, and then you begin to inquire further. And once you start going down that path, you become a much, much bigger person than you think you are. And this is why it's so important to look at these mysteries like Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. You know, why are there seven dwarfs, for example? Why not eight? Why not six? Once you start looking into the methodology of how they encode this information, it's amazing how much actually there is and why it's like Star Wars, why it's so popular. It actually touches a nerve inside you because, you know, truth has a ring to it, as you know.
Absolutely. We are finding that those that deal with free energy that are trying to come up in these new high technologies, maybe even the creators of CERN, have tapped into the Akashic records and pulled these datas out. They admit this, many of the scientists that are dealing with free energy devices.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, one of the things that I was amazed at when I was researching the material for The Last Art of Resurrection, and it's not really... The title is actually quite misleading because, I mean, we talk about resurrection, you know, one thing comes to mind, and that's always the story of a guy that gets nailed to a cross, gets up 3 days later. That's not what it was about at all. The whole thing was a metaphor to begin with. It was actually a symbol of how the initiate is nailed to the cross of matter, disappears into the other world through a controlled near-death experience, which is a very hair-raising ritual, and then returns to become a better person, a god, if you like. And the one thing that I found in the remaining excerpts of and descriptions of people who did this which includes people like Pythagoras and Plato, and quite possibly Leonardo da Vinci, is that they all claimed that when they actually went into this another level of existence in an out-of-body state, they actually were able to pull up some extraordinary information about, for example, how nature really works in the mechanics of the cosmos. And once they came back, and this is why it took so long to actually do this ritual and why it went through years of preparation, is because unlike shamanism, you remembered everything when you came back. Now, you try to do that in your dream states when you're asleep. You wake up in the morning and you think, you know, I was having a really good dream last night, and I can't remember a damn thing about it. This was different. They had complete cognition of what happened on the other side when they returned to their body, and they went on to apply it in daily life. So people like Nikola Tesla, for example, I'm sure that he was privy to some of that information as well, because the stuff that he comes up with is basically the manipulation of the laws of nature for our benefit. Everyone that went through this ritual process talks about exactly the same thing, that you do go there specifically to look for specific information from this astral reference library, what some people call the Akashic Record, and pull back information that's pertinent to your reason why you're here in this particular lifetime. And it helps you do your job much better, with greater clarity, and to a certain event, with a certain degree of control over the manifestation process, which is very important. If you have control of that, you can do a lot of important things in your life. And also, this is the reason why information was kept from nefarious people, like church people, who wanted this information for pure power. That's not what it's about. This is about the betterment of yourself, empowerment of yourself, and also to raise everyone along with you. So I totally agree that these people obviously were doing this for very, very important reasons in order to bring about a certain level of raising consciousness in the human race.
Absolutely. And we find that these people are often behind the leadership. They are the men behind the men. We look at John Dee, who brought the queen over here, or Apollonius, oh, yeah, behind so many different Roman emperors. And I had mentioned Nicholas Roerich, who actually was a guru for Henry Wallace and convinced Wallace to put the eye in the pyramid on the back of the dollar bill. And Nicholas,
you all know what that means.
What do you think it means? I mean, I openly, I don't know.
Well, it's an old Masonic symbol, Scottish Rite Freemasonry, which is the true progeny of the Knights Templar, who are themselves the progeny of the Essenes, who are themselves the progeny of other Middle Eastern sects that go back 5,000 years. It was a symbol about reaching the highest level of one's potential. They revered God as a force, not necessarily as a person, and certainly not within a religious context. And the idea was that whenever you showed the all-seeing eye on top of the pyramid, it pretty much defined that the people who had put this information there were basically running a country, a kind of a shadow government without the negative connotations. They were running a kind of shadow government and telling people that it's the Masons that have control over the actual affairs of normal human beings in order to elevate society to a higher potential, because that essentially is what real Freemasonry is about. You can argue this point in all kinds of areas, and I'm familiar with many people who are Scottish Rite Masons, and they'll tell you that there are, you know, people who are doing the information, using the information with the right means and right intent, and there are those, of course, who are doing it for completely wrong intent, for controlling people, substituting presidents for the wrong presidents, if you know what I mean, essentially doing very nefarious things for a privileged few. But that's not really what it's about. So when they put the symbol of the pyramid with the all-seeing eye on the dollar bill, essentially you are defining a country by the people who are essentially controlling the wisdom that is a foundation of that new society, and is essentially a symbol of God as a creative force. The pyramid itself is one of the most archetypal symbols and simplest symbols of the force of the forces of nature. Anybody that goes to the Great Pyramid of Giza will understand this, where you actually look at all different kinds of pyramids in Egypt. They're all different shapes. They're not all quite the same. and they all elicit a slightly different effect. And essentially, the Great Pyramid is different, and it seems to pull on your senses more than any other, simply by the virtue that its angles, its position, its relative angles of geometry to its interior passages are such that they do actually bend the laws of nature. And if you ever have the chance to go in there and have a couple of hours of very quiet time by yourself, you will understand this. And I didn't know how powerful this stuff was until I myself went in there one day for completely different reasons. And I actually saw with four other people in the total darkness after doing a quiet meditation in there, we actually saw people coming out of the stones surrounding us. And it was a wonderful experience. And I've also read from the 1920s that that happened to another individual. And I have since come across another person who works with sound energy in the Great Pyramid. He's actually a scientist who said that, yes, there are times when we hit a certain frequency in that building, and I actually see people coming out of the stones, and it's a very moving and loving experience. So that's what it means when you actually put the pyramid symbol on a dollar bill. You are showing that someone has understanding of this information. And if you are curious, well, come and talk to us, because we have a story for you.
Absolutely. And I couldn't agree with that more, and realize, folks, that Nicholas Roerich had a building commissioned for him downtown in New York City. It was called the Master Building, and you can go look this up. And the Master Building was actually engineered at the penthouse as a Tibetan temple designed like Ghostbusters to channel entities into that building where his wife would channel Moria. And they would get their information, and, you know, this information then was led to the U.S. government. And when we start to look at this puzzle, we see, I mean, when they built the United States and they built Washington, D.C., I mean, it wasn't easy to put pentagrams in the street plans of D.C. To build a building that then channels energies. Or since we are talking conspiracy as well, the Georgia Guidestones that have the name R.C. Christian put on them also seem to identify with the same type of, like, outward thinking.
Yeah, I mean, it's I have a very a bit of a joke that you know, the great thing about it, you know there's a conspiracy existing when there's a complete lack of evidence. I've come across so many people, and I don't mean to denigrate people who are into conspiracy theories. I mean, it's all part of the fun of being alive. The problem is that conspiracies are very hard to prove. You're relying on hearsay, interpretation. But I see where it comes from, because my research really goes into the center of where the stuff comes from, and the understanding of temple design and temple building, which is essentially the observation of nature, the manipulation of subtle energy, the use of sacred geometry, and the strategic use of stone as well. All of these things conspire to create an environment that mimics nature and actually amplifies it to a certain degree. So when you're talking about Washington, if you take that as an example, we go back to the time when the Scottish Rite Masons were creating a new country. And back then, of course, they're trying to escape the English and the French and the Spanish and all the suppression that was happening in Europe. So that's the context in which they were trying to create a new society for the highest level of humanity. And the idea was to take all these old ideas of temple building, and they looked at things like Luxor and Karnak in Egypt, which was essentially used as the blueprint for creating central Paris, which is why we like Paris so much, because underneath all of those streets, strange angles, and old roads leading to the Arc de Triomphe and so forth, if you actually do the mathematics and the geometry, all of that stuff is actually hardwired into the actual plan of the city. You can't see it, but you can feel it. And that is the way that you get away with having pentagrams hidden in plain view. So essentially what the founding fathers did was to improve on that and create a blueprint in the middle of a marsh called Washington. And we have that center of power. Now, here's the rub, because this information can, again, be used both ways. Subtle energy is just energy. It doesn't know right from wrong. It's your intent as a person that defines its purpose. So when you have a group of people that actually has the right intent as I believe the early people did in creating this country, they actually worked with very ancient laws of measure, sacred measure, of sacred geometry, angles, energy manipulation, and they tried to create a kind of hard drive, which is the center of government. And the idea was that this image of perfection would then slowly leak out into the landscape. It would affect people from Washington all the way to Seattle, and somehow people would reverberate to that wonderful frequency. And it can happen. It does happen from time to time, depending on who's in charge of this energy and this power. Sometimes you get the right president and the right people in power who do serve as a good symbol. Sometimes you get the wrong person in power and everything goes haywire. So it's they're essentially doing what the ancient Egyptians were doing 5,000 years ago in order to create a perfect society. These temples that you see everywhere around the world, they are mirror images of the perfection of the heavens. Because in the old days, they reckoned that because the stars and the planets all move within a certain synchronistic manner, this perfection, which is totally untampered by human imperfection, would be an admirable thing to recreate on the ground. And that's why the places that we visit, that we love so much, there's a certain thing about them that pulls you in, because they feel right, because they are right. They are perfect mirror images of the cosmos. So in order to recreate that balance on Earth and to make sure that people are privy to that information and to that energy, they would create entire temple cities that would mimic that perfection and hope that people would vibrate to that. So again, like I said, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, because you've got human nature that gets involved. And sometimes people come at this with completely the wrong intent. And then you have the problems that, like we have right now. In this country, we have a bit of a division going on, you may have noticed.
Without a doubt. As a matter of fact, I believe that's what my Free Your Mind conference speech is going to be on.
Oh, good.
It is the most standing thing right in front of us now, that amount of division in every way, shape, and form. I mean, oh my God, Shaquille O'Neal is now a flat earther. Did you ever think that would come back?
Nothing surprises me anymore.
Yeah.
In fact, it's kind of funny that it's happening now as we speak, because this is the equinox. And it's people that I usually meet on the road who are staunch New Agers, which are in complete contrast to skeptics. And they both basically are correct. It just depends on your point of view. The one thing that everybody seems to miss out on is the fact that when you're trying to throw too much light into something, it creates its opposite, or it at least attracts its very opposite. That's the law of cause and effect here on Earth, and it's the most frustrating thing to try and overcome. You may read all the books, you may do all the meditations, go to the right places, speak to the right holy people, listen to the right podcasts, and then you still flummoxed by the fact that things are still very squiffy around you. But that's the whole point of Earth, is because it's a place of contrast and sometimes extremes. And the fact that we're here at the equinox actually typifies what the actual teachings were really about. It's about understanding the light and the dark and finding the balance in both. The idea is to walk the line in between and be aware that both extremes exist. Not too lighty, not too darky, just right. And this is why it was so important in the old days during the initiation ceremonies. This would be the day when the initiates were actually raised from the dead. That was their euphemism. And they used to call this a euphemism because before they were experienced to the other world and they came back with their eyes completely opened, they were considered dead. Essentially, people who are normal, who are born, they go through a different life, a difficult life, and then they die and they think that's it. Now, these people, once they had the initiation at the equinox, they came back risen from the dead because they are now living. They are truly alive. They can see the world through different eyes. They see that the physical world is not the end-all and be-all of everything. There's a much bigger world in the invisible world that most of us are not aware of. But once you become aware of that and you see your place in it and how you interact with this invisible world and how you can actually ask it to interact with you, now you are truly living. So it's a very momentous occasion on this equinox to actually describe the process that, you know, we're surrounded within political terms here. The trick is not to get too caught up in the process itself, but to understand the process and see how you can, you know, influence it so it comes back to the middle. So we're going to go through some challenging times for sure, but I think it also helps to wake people up to their complacency. And then it also helps to redress certain imbalances that were prominent when things felt very good. So I think that in the bigger scheme of things, these things happen, these political processes that we don't necessarily agree with, do happen for a very good reason in the end. The trick is just to sit with it, you know, acknowledge that it exists and try and find a way to bring it back to the center, which is the path of the true initiate.
I wonder what David Rockefeller was thinking.
Well, you know, David actually was an interesting person. I never gave him much thought until my original research with the crop circles in England and then throughout the world. He actually sponsored quite a bit of the research. He was very curious about trying to understand the mechanism behind the crop circles, and he certainly saw the spiritual potential of them. And that kind of sort of showed me a different side of him that I really wasn't aware of, and there probably wouldn't have been otherwise. So many of these people, you tend to get a certain perception of them through the media, but that's not necessarily the whole truth. I mean, we only get a slice of what people really are, and then we make our judgments from them. And I think that's very short-sighted of us. I think you really have to understand people on a very intimate level to understand the complexity of any individual. And certainly that was a big surprise to me that he was totally involved in crop circle research to see how we can further this whole concept. Because as I proved in my first book, Secrets in the Fields, the crop circles are actually nothing more than a bunch of pyramids actually made out of wheat. They have exactly the same processes, the same geometries, same manipulation of subtle energy, and the same changes in personal consciousness, which is why, in my opinion, they're the most important phenomenon happening in our time. We start building sacred space to remind us of our connection with a bigger picture, and I think that these designs are actually filling in the blank. It's getting us to reevaluate our position.
So arcane symbols being placed as frequency modulation. Let's take that concept, crop circles, along with the ideas of frequency modulators like HARP and ionospheric heaters, and how this, do you think on those lines?
Oh, I think on every single line. I think it's important. I think it's important for any researcher or writer to take a wider view as possible, which is why it takes me years to come up with a book. And I think people recognize that it requires depth. It requires perception and experience to be able to see wider than your own personal view. So I pull my information from a weird bunch of topics. HARP is a great example of technology, which is basically harnessed to the same information that is encoded in ancient temples, if you believe this. And they basically took that to another technological level, and they're trying to manipulate the atmosphere. I don't think that's a very good idea to work and manipulate the natural world when we have so little understanding of the natural world and how it actually works. I think the side effects have already been shown to be quite detrimental. So we're talking about, again, the application of natural laws in the wrong hands, possibly from their point of view with the right intent. I don't necessarily agree with that intent, but from their point of view, they probably think they're doing the right thing. But again, you're manipulating natural laws to create an outcome which may not do us any good. And I think this is part of the reason why the weather is a little bit off-centered right now as well, not just global warming. I think it's also self-induced by this errant technology. So yeah, it's the same. It's another side of the same card, I believe.
Yeah, and CERN doesn't hide from their occult roots either.
Absolutely. But again, it's are they doing the right thing with the right intent? Are they actually trying to replicate ideas that were done a long time ago for the matter of control or manipulation. That's where you get into a little bit of a gray area, because only the people that are directly involved in those processes know the truth. We're on the periphery watching and judging without the full amount of information. It's almost like you have to sort of take yourself out of body, do a little meditation, and try and tune into what's really going on and get that gut feeling. I think that the people that are working at CERN are probably trying to do the right thing. But again, when you're dealing with something where you're trying to manipulate the natural laws of the cosmos without a full understanding of the implications of what you might be doing, things might not turn out as well as they thought that they might. But then again, you have on the other side, you have people like Tesla, who were doing exactly the same thing, but they wanted to do it for the right reasons. I was just watching the film The Prestige for the 15th time, mostly because David Bowie pulls off a great performance in one take as Nikola Tesla, and he was the only person that could actually play that part. And it reminded me so much that this person really was way ahead of the pack. He was trying to, you know, bring a much bigger understanding of energy and how the world really works to humanity. And the first time he succeeded, he was raised as a hero. And the second time, of course, he was pilloried. And we all know the story that happened from there, where the powers that be began to take his power away by trying to use that information in order to control people. So again, it's that sort of wonderful dark and light theater that we get here on Earth. And I think it's one of the reasons why we get attracted to incarnate here. It's that wonderful play between worlds.
Absolutely. And, you know, Bowie was deep into the Ordo Templi Orientis. And of course, Disney was the producer of The Prestige.
Yes, and we go back exactly to where we began the interview.
Yeah.
We've gone around in a complete circle. Yeah, and again, they try to incorporate this information in a way that the public can, that it becomes palpable to the, palatable to the public. But a few people, hopefully such as ourselves, can see through films like that and go, wait a minute, there's another story in here, and it's much juicier than just a pure entertainment. Power to them.
Yeah. Well, since we've touched on the Templars and the Order of Eastern Templars, what about the Ark of the Covenant? So this obviously is very much a classic example of a sacred science.
Oh, very much so. In fact, it's always fun reading these things in the Bible and see what it's all about. If you actually travel to Egypt and down the temples of the Nile, you can see a lot of the Arks of the Covenant painted on the temple walls, and people walk right past them. They take photographs and they're completely unaware. If you happen to be going near Luxor or Karnak, and even I believe the Temple of Philae has one as well, you'll go into one of the inner sanctums of the temple and you see a big boat. And there's usually an image of a god at either end of the boat. And in the middle of the boat, there is a certain overhang or a little alcove. And there's another sort of stone god or a depiction of a god inside it. That is essentially the depiction of the Ark of the Covenant. And my colleague Graham Hancock wrote a very good a very good book years and years ago, trying to trace the origin of the Ark all the way down from Jerusalem, down the Nile, all the way down into Ethiopia. And I think he made a very good case for its position in Ethiopia.
Oh, the moment he was in the Holy of Holies and they caught him and beat him, I was riveted. I couldn't put, it was epic.
Oh, dear. Well, he does sort of, he is Scottish. He does put his nose in there where it shouldn't be.
Good for
from
him.
Their point of view.
Yeah, now that Zahi Hawass is out of the picture,
But I think he made a very good point, actually. And I think that there is something very important about the Ark, which we've yet to fully grasp. And I think a lot of it was, I think the people who actually were in charge of it understood that it would be misused. And I think my gut feeling is that it's been taken apart and it's actually in certain bits all around the world. I think the actual casing of the Ark itself is actually in Ethiopia. I do agree with Graham's research on this, but I do think the essential components are actually elsewhere. And the reason is, and I come across this many, many times around the world, is the people, the initiates of the temple, they could see far, they could travel. And even in the in Peru, they talk about this, how, you know, the inner people of the inner sanctum, they could travel far without moving. That's the actual description. So they could actually see events in the future and realize that we go through cycles in the human realm. We come here for a personal experience, but also we are part of a collective experience. And these collective experiences take about 4,300 years to complete. So we're now coming to the end of one and starting another one. You may have noticed things are a little bit sort of chaotic right there. They recognize that everything has its place. And this arc, this technology, which again seems to be related to the harnessing of natural laws, it was going to end up in the wrong hands by the wrong people. And these people being smart enough, they would have said, okay, I think we should give humans in that future period in time an idea of what is achievable. But until they come to another age where enlightenment is king or queen, we're going to basically take the arc apart. We're going to put part A over here, part B over there. And it's going to take them at least a couple of thousand years to try and put the whole thing back together, during which time they would have raised their level of consciousness a bit more. And then just when they hit that moment when they say, ah, that's how you're supposed to do it, that's when I believe we will find all the pieces of the arc and it will all come together. I actually found a little bit in Portugal, of all places, because the arc, when you actually look at what happens in the world of the Ethiopians and their etymology, it helped me to understand one of the biggest Templar secrets in Portugal, which is the subject of my my fourth book. And I actually found a connection to the arc in a very archaic folk festival in this particular town, which is totally connected with the Templars. In fact, they actually founded the entire town. And you will be there as a tourist watching this procession, which takes place once every 4 years, which is supposed to be the festivity declaring the highest point of the light in the year, which is the summer solstice. Now, that happens every year. Why would they be doing this every 4 years? That's your first clue. They're trying to say that this story, there's more than meets the eye. And when you actually look at the etymology of the name of this festival, it links back all the way to Ethiopia. And there's something about the instructions, something about the tablets that were in the ark, which I believe are actually hidden in Portugal right now. And I think there was a tunnel that I found that was related to the Templars' secret initiation temple inside one of their main buildings in Portugal. And I began to ask a few questions, and suddenly all the doors came down around me, and that's the last time anyone communicated with me. So it tells me that I got very close to the honeypot. And I'm trying to work with people within the government in Portugal who are high-ranking Masons, who do want to excavate into this tunnel and find the original chamber. And I believe in the next few years, maybe the next 5 years, we are going to see some very important information coming out from that part of the world. So stay tuned for that one.
Okay. All right. Wow.
And if they assassinate me, you'll know I was right, by the way.
Yeah, isn't that the worst? I hate that fact.
It's a bitch trying to correct royalties when you're dead, you know?
Right. Well, there was a really strange moment. I reported on it back years ago. Actually, it goes back to the piracy of the Sirius Star. And there was a moment where an Ethiopian priest, I don't remember if he was a cardinal, announced to the world that he was going to reveal the Ark of the Covenant to everyone, but that he had to first go check with the Pope, who was Pope Benedict at that time. And he then vanishes from the public scene and then returns and says, oh yeah, well, we do have the Ark, but I never said I was going to show it to you. And it was, you know, it was there. And at that moment was when they announced the piracy of the Sirius Star. And I'm always watching for Masonic code like that in things, just like the USS Mason that was recently under attack. But the Sirius Star, obviously, is, you know, a high esoteric order. And every nation in the world came to the Gulf of Yemen over this Sirius Star piracy. I mean, China, Japan, America, Russia, everybody was there, right? And then there were reports of this magnetic anomaly over the Gulf of Yemen that ties in with Cain and all kinds of craziness. And I just, you know, that was a story that I covered. I remember covering, but I haven't been able to re-find the article ever again.
I mean, again, it depends who's in charge of the Vatican. I think we're actually, so many of my books, there's a sort of anti-Catholic sort of sentiment through it, and for a very good reason, because the early Christian church that did not survive the persecution of the fundamentalist Catholic movement, which became the Catholic Church, they always describe this movement as a false church. It's a false religion, and they have very good evidence. And we know this because when the suppressed gospels were found and dug up in Nag Hammadi and also in the Sea of Galilee, they actually undermined the whole authority of the church. But you know what? I kind of like this new pope. He's been doing and saying the right things, and I think we may be at that moment again where we have the right person doing the right thing in the wrong place in order to bring some light to the situation. So again, it's that play of light and dark, you know. It actually teaches me that you can never pillory anybody fully, because within everybody there's always a sense that they have the chance to redeem themselves. I mean, I was just reading an article today in the paper about George Bush suddenly finding redemption in painting, and he seems to be a completely changed person. So you never know, you know. People do have a chance, just like Darth Vader, to come back from the dark and see the light. So we always give them a little bit of room just to make sure that, you know, they show the world that there is a much better picture out there than we've been painted.
Yes, Donald Trump, Putin, and Pope Francis. Wow.
Yeah, some of those I actually have a time imagining ever returning to the light. But, you know, you have to hold out some hope, otherwise we're lost.
Yes, absolutely. And let's give a little hope as we wrap up this hour and discuss a little bit about the methodology of a living resurrection experience.
Well, that was fascinating because, again, like I said, my understanding of resurrection, and it always brings up this picture, which we know so well, burned into our subconscious by the church over 1800 years, actually was not what it was at all. Living resurrection, as it was called back in the day, essentially described the process of an initiate who joined the mystery schools, and they basically formed a society apart from everybody else. You would go to an inn, and you'd hear a troubadour telling a story or playing a song, and you'd go, that's interesting. But I was reading between the lines, and actually I seem to get a sense that what you're saying is something different. That's how they used to get your attention, the people in the temple, and they would say, you want to hang out with us? We're going to show you something different. So they would take you aside. They would put you under a process of observation for a year to make sure that you were A, responsible, B, you could be trusted with the information that you were about to be given, and you weren't going to run away with it and use it for nefarious purposes. So once you get past this preliminary period, the next 2 years were spent teaching you the bigger mysteries of life and to see through the lies that have been taught through people who control the information, you know, not 1,000 miles removed from what we do today. And after that, once you reach a certain level of understanding, then you'd be prepared for the final rite of initiation. Now, I ought to point out that initiation means to become conscious. That's what the word actually means. And in order to make you more conscious while you are living, they would basically put you in a state of fasting for about a week, and then they would invest in you a new robe. You were taken into a secret chamber, which is usually a place inside a great pyramid or a restricted room in a temple, and you'd be made to go into a sarcophagus or a kind of natural cave. And this happened all around the world. I've got examples from China all the way through Persia, through Africa, Europe, Native America, and Polynesia. Everybody was doing this, and in some places they still are. And the next bit was the most secret. It was very hard to find information on what happened next. And what happened was that they would make a tincture out of a poison. There are certain herbs that they found that if you took a certain percentage of this herb, you could actually induce a near-death experience where basically you could leave the body for a whole week and your heart will be beating about one beat a second, one beat a minute rather, and somehow they were able to master this technique to keep your body alive long enough, and it would allow you to leave the body and roam the other world. And that's where you had a great time for anywhere between 3 to 7 days. And you would meet gods. You'd have an extraordinary time seeing the most unbelievable paradisiacal landscapes. But you also were there to work. You went there to get information and knowledge. And you would come back and very, very giddy. And during this time, a group of priestesses would have been humming around your body. And they did this to actually create a kind of force field whereby, you know, because they recognize that your body is nothing more than a physical vessel. Your soul is actually who you are. And if your soul leaves for a certain amount of period, there is a danger that another soul might enter your body. So they didn't want that. And they also didn't want you to be left somewhere in limbo. So they would actually, the priestesses who had the highest entry level into the actual temple, they were regarded as the highest people within the temple structure, which is one reason why the church became so patriarchal, by the way. They hummed around your body to create a kind of force field to protect you. So when you came back into the body, usually on the dawn of the spring equinox, you were taken physically out of the sarcophagus by the priestesses, and you're still very groggy. You still don't know where the hell you've been or what's going on. You just know you had a great time. And so you're in the middle of this difficult return back into the physical world, and the priestesses would take you outside of the temple or the pyramid or the sacred cave, and you'd stand on this sacred mound, and the first thing you'd see would be Venus rising above the dawn sky, the first bright object before the sun. So your view of the morning star was your symbol that you were now declared risen from the dead. And that tradition, essentially, it was replayed all around the world. I mean, there's very few variations. Even in Polynesian islands we've never even heard of or couldn't even place on a map. But essentially, the process was very, very identical. So, which brings us, of course, to even more questions. You know, did people at one point 6,000 years ago, because that's about as far back as I can trace this information, did someone actually shamanically induce this information from a natural reference library? Or was there a central point of information, a missing land, for example, where people already understood this information, and then following a major catastrophe here on Earth, out of desperation, they communicated to the survivors, the us human beings, this important ritual that it's any of us are privy to actually experience at any time if we want to, and actually keep this thing going for thousands of years onwards. I think that there's some truth to this, because if you talk to people in India, they'll say, well, we don't necessarily practice this ritual today because of legal constraints. I mean, trying to get someone to have an induced near-death experience may not be the kind of thing that your lawyer wants to hear, or even the government for that matter. So they say, but there are techniques such as Kriya Yoga, for example, where you learn to manipulate the energy field of your own body because you are a temple after all. I mean, even Jesus says that in the Bible. And that the temple of God resides within yourself. And once you've learned that, then you can actually have this out-of-body journey yourself. So it's not so much of a dead, lost art. It's just a misplaced art of resurrection. We just have to sort of find it in the right context. Sometimes when I take people on tours to the sacred sites around the world, and we were talking about Guatemala and Mexico just before we came on the air. And there are temples, for example, at Palenque, the tomb of Pakal, which is not a tomb to begin with. That was the initiation chamber. So if you can get a chance to go in there, and I believe it costs about $40 of backsheesh to get private access in there.
And don't go on Monday.
Oh, good.
Yeah, never go to a museum on Monday, folks. All right, that's my new set rule. I mean, like I was saying, 2 miles of stairs, and it was closed. So I didn't get to see the cover, the sarcophagus lid, as it's called. So you would say, I mean, is Pakal in there?
His body is, I believe, is actually in the museum, along with the mask and everything. But everything else is pretty much in place.
But he was entombed in that.
He was eventually entombed. And if I read the story correctly of what they wrote, I mean, Pakal's family is part of because we're talking now here the 8th century AD. Not many people at that point in time around the world, and specifically in Europe and to a certain degree in Central Europe, not many people still understood this initiation process of living resurrection. It was lost. It went underground. It was misplaced. I mean, the Aztecs were classic in the fact that they totally misunderstood the idea, and they went around ripping the hearts out of living people in order to appease the gods. They completely misunderstood what the actual scriptures were trying to tell them. They took it literally, not metaphorically, about the defleshing of the body. That was not what it was about. Same with the ball courts. No one ever got killed in the ball courts. So there's not a shred of evidence to back that up, and that's not what they were used for anyway. So Pakal came from what is one of the last people in a lineage of initiates who understood the process. So eventually when he dies, his sons kind of carried on with him for another generation, but they buried him in that building and they closed it off because they recognized that that temple is now done, the time is finished. We have to move on to another era. So what started off as an initiatory temple, and there are passages in there which really are superfluous for a burial site, which is the thing that gives it all away. Eventually, they shut off the whole building. They buried this important man in it, and we've come to associate it with a tomb, but that's not what it was about. It's like calling the Great Pyramid a tomb. It was never used as a tomb, and there's not a shred of evidence to back that up either.
Well, again, with David Rockefeller dying on the spring equinox, I just hope that they don't have a resurrection device. I'm sorry to say, I just don't want that to happen.
He comes back as Luke Skywalker.
yeah, you know, maybe there'll be that transformation like W. Maybe he was painting in the other world and has come back. And, you know, that's really a key ingredient, is us to feel that peace of mind, our God self, enough to be able to create art. Because it really takes that sense of peace to be able to create art.
Yeah, it does. And it's part of that sort of moment where you are in between worlds. You're not really in the other world. You're not in this world. You're running that fine line in between. And that's something that was also very important in the Mystery Secrets, is tapping into that consciousness, that subtle energy, when you're in a waking state. And that's the place where so many artists, so many writers do and look for. For example, I mean, speaking from experience, I can barely remember writing my first book, which becomes a bestseller. I mean, who would have known? It just seems to have just manifested quite by itself, as though I was tapping into something very different. I would get emails from people I'd never heard of, and when I'd reply to them, the email actually didn't exist. The address did not exist. It would bounce. And they would supply me the clue for the problem that I was in the middle of writing. So there is this magic that exists within our world and all around us. We just have to be aware of it and then find the correct method and tool with which to approach that kind of subtle world. And then once you start writing it, just like driving a car, the more you do it, the better you get at it. And then it becomes second nature. And then that's when you realize that you are a god. You are a very extraordinarily powerful person. You just get talked out of it through life. But don't let them talk it out of you, because you can achieve extraordinary things if you just apply yourself to it.
That is the art of creative play, folks. I'll tell you what. Freddie, this has been an amazing show. I could talk to you for hours and hours.
Likewise.
But we got to go. It's over. We're out of time. So, folks, his website is invisibletemple.com. And tell us what's up and coming. I think you got a new project coming out. And tell people how they could maybe go on a tour with you.
Yeah, I'm working on some very juicy stuff, very difficult stuff. It's quite challenging, and hopefully it might come to fruition later in the year. So, but it's to do with the catastrophe that happened on Earth in 9703 BC, Tuesday, I think it was. We have now actual geological evidence that we got hit by fragments of a very large comet, which is where so many of our myths of God suddenly escaping a sinking land come from. But I wanted to write it from a different point of view. I wanted to show some different information reaction to the one that's already been presented. I'm obviously promoting The Last Art of Resurrection because I think it's so important that we understand the concept of what it was and what it still is and how important it is for our personal development. And of course, on my website, you'll see all the upcoming tours that I'm planning. And sometimes I only take 6 people to some of these sites. I want these things to be personal. I want it to be fun. And we have a lot of fun.
Fantastic. Wow. I'm gonna find my way to one of those, Freddie. I promise. Yeah, I'm building up my miles. No, somehow it's going to happen.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Wow. What an amazing show. I mean, we went all over the place and covered so many different secret societies and secret men behind the men and the magic that brings us back to life. I feel empowered right now with this.
Oh, good.
Yes. Absolutely.
That's what it's all about. It's about recognizing the, I spent many, many years in advertising and getting sucked into this vortex of real life. And I gave it up and all the money that went with it to do something that one day when I die, I can say, you know, I've left the world 1% better than when I found it. And it is. It's important to keep track of the headlines to find out what the snakes are up to. Just don't get caught up in the minutiae of it. Give your power to someone who can directly make a difference to these things that we want to see change in the world. But if you can't be directly involved, just send them a bit of energy and then take care of your own garden. You know, make it a beautiful garden. And other people will look at it and say, hey, this person's got it right. I want to do what they're doing. And that's the best way you can do. You know, don't overstretch yourself. Don't worry about it too much. Everything has its correct place at the right time.
Well, can I say, Freddie Silva, you are a great heretic.
Do you know what the meaning of heretic is?
Please define that.
In the original Oxford English Dictionary, someone in possession of the facts who has the ability to choose.
Someone in the possession of facts that has the abilities to choose. Are we a bunch of heretics here, folks? I think we are. I'm so glad all of you are on the ride with us, and I'm glad that you're exploring these wonderful worlds. I hope we gave you a bunch of places to look into. I mean, we brought about many names that rarely come up in these topics and understandings of how we are living temples, and temples have been designed to engender a resurrection experience. And right now, obviously, is the biggest time of division and the best time for you to seek that inner peace. So I hope you all will take this to heart and realize, just as Freddie was saying, that, you know, change the things that you can around you. And as people witness that, they will change the things around them. That's the best way you could do it. So thank you all so much for tuning in. And members, I'm going to give you some special broadcasts of Manly P. Hall so that you get a little deeper into this knowledge than most. It's an amazing ride. And as you've learned, both Freddie and I are fans of Manly Palmer Hall. Amazing stuff. By the way, Freddie, the first thing you'll see when you walk in Manly P. Hall's library is a statue of Nicholas Roerich.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
Yeah, I don't know. but you're gonna be blown away. I want to talk to you again after you look at Nicholas Roerich and his paintings. And I sent you the link to the photography. Folks, I put the photography section back on freemantv.com. It was slowing things down, but it's fixed. So it's right there. You go to watch and go to photography. And I have all of Nicholas Roerich's paintings. And you're going to be blown away, Freddie, by what he depicted as he was paid by the U.S. government to go around and do these sacred rituals in underground Tibetan chambers with giant crystal structures. And you're going to be blown away by this guy.
I'm sure I will.
So, folks, thank you all so much for tuning in. Members, I hope you enjoy this little lecture from Manly P. Hall. And if you haven't subscribed yet, get over to freemantv.com. Check out the 12 years of data that's there. And, you know, realize there's no such thing as an old show. This is exploration. We are exploring our worlds. And it has nothing to do with the time of day, because as you can tell, we're talking about 10,500 years ago. So into the future as well. So there you go. Thank you all so much. We'll see you all next week.